everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we'll be discovering Bloody Scotland with Queen of Tartan Noir, Lynn Anderson.
Well, we do aim to do things slightly differently in Scotland, so there is a Scottish quirkiness about it.
Ben McIntyre lets us into some MI6 secrets.
I mean, one of the extraordinary things about intelligence files is that they are honest in a way that most government files are not.
And I talk to Ruta Sepetys, the winner of this year's Silip Carnegie Medal.
What would it be like for the children, for these innocent victims of war and vengeful regimes?
That's all coming up in today's show. Lynn Anderson is a leading light in tartan noir crime fiction. She's best known as the creator of Rona McLeod, a Glasgow-based forensic scientist. But she's also the co-founder of the annual Bloody Scotland Crime Writing Festival. With the publication of the 12th Rona McLeod novel and the festival just around the corner, I caught up with Lynn as she got ready for both events. So, Lynn Anderson, welcome to Read On Air.
Well, thank you for asking me. I was delighted.
Just for those who aren't familiar with the term, can you explain what tartan noir is, please?
The number of people have been asked that, so probably multiple answers. Well, tartan noir, probably its originator was Willie McIlvany with a book called Laidlaw, set in Glasgow, a detective who was, as Willie said, a man first and a detective second. From those beginnings came Ian Rankin, Val McDermid, pretty well everybody in the canon of Scottish crime writing will say how inspired they were by that book, which spoke in the language of the place and really shone a light into the social situation that people were living in. And I mean, one of these great quotes from Laidlaw that I always remember is, "Who is the true monster among us?" Because he didn't just look at the crime, he looked at circumstances and the sort of psychological aspects of it. So I think tartan noir definitely sort of encompasses that, but from a Scottish perspective, it's probably the only thing that I can see other than that.
Why do you think Scotland is such a fertile ground for crime fiction?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, there was the golden era of crime fiction in England, didn't really exist in Scotland, and we don't have a background of the sort of crime among the upper classes, you know, the Agatha Christie and the Hercule Poirot, and, you know, it was essentially a crime among the upper classes. We didn't have that here. Ian Rankin often talks about the border ballads, you know, our stories of the past, or maybe that's why Bloody Scotland's called Bloody Scotland, and sort of that was where our crime writing came from. Before Willie, there was, of course, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and that idea that there is bad and good in all of us, and, you know, people aren't defined by one or the other, it's the situation you put them in that makes them go a certain way, and so R.L. Stevenson was a big impact. There's also his sort of adventure book, like Kidnap, that was a big influence on me. So that idea of storytelling is a big thing. I mean, I'm half Irish, so storytelling in both Ireland, both halves of me, everybody had to have a good story. And it was interesting, though, actually, when we had the first Bloody Scotland, Ian launched it up in Stirling, and what he said was, "Scandinavia doesn't have better crime writers than Scotland. It has better PR." And we set off, that was what Bloody Scotland was to do, was to, you know, although we had some very big names that were obviously international, there was this huge other wealth of we knew was there, but wasn't getting a platform, you know, and we wanted to share that internationally.
And it's proved remarkably successful, Bloody Scotland. It attracts people from all over the world. And I believe it's a great opportunity for you not only to meet with other crime writers, but actually your fans as well.
Yes. Well, we do aim to do things slightly differently in Scotland. So there is a Scottish quirkiness about it, although it does, you know, obviously we have international writers. A lot of our great writers from the south of the border, from Ireland. But we also do, you know, we do other things which have sort of developed. And the thing that sells out literally within an hour or two is Crime at the Coup. The Coup's a pub in Stirling, not far from our main centre for the festival. And we started this Crime at the Coup where crime writers perform, you know, something other than writing. They performed on stage, and I found it quite fascinating. I mean, I used to sing in a band as well, so did Alex Gray, but then to actually find most of these crime writers also, you know, sang and played musical instruments, it was fascinating. So we've sort of extended that a little bit this year as well, in that we've got Crime at the Coup sells out so fast, it's not a big venue. So we're doing another event with the band. Val is very good, I have to say.
It sounds like great fun and a lot less po-faced than maybe some people's visions of literary festivals might be.
Yeah, I think that's a bit... I mean, I'm a big fan of Edinburgh, and it's wonderful to see the crowds of people and the children's area. But you still do, I know when I go out to libraries, I do a lot of events in libraries as well as festivals, and you get people in library that will come to see you and they wouldn't actually think of going to a book festival. But once they realise there are, you know, once you encourage them to go, I've had a few people and then they go to events and they realise that's for them too. Probably the thing that struck me most is a couple of years ago, we had Joe Nesbo at Bloody Scotland, fantastic writer, great guy. I found myself seated next to two young guys, and they told me honestly this is the first time in their life they had ever considered for a moment going to a book festival. So I think it's that kind of literary word, I think, you know, people think, oh, that would be too highbrow for me. And crime writing, from my own experience, and you would hear this from many crime writers, is a very friendly world for writers. You know, we are very supportive of one another, which is why you could set up something like Bloody Scotland and people would just say, I'll come. Very supportive of one another, but there's also a very close connection between the readers and the writers. I mean, we don't sit in a yurt separate from anybody. You know, we all congregate in the bar. You can go and talk to anybody you like. And I think that atmosphere... people love that, because without our readers, we can't be writers, you know, so talking to them is fantastic.
Well, I wonder if maybe that is one of the special features of crime writing, because you have to exchange ideas with the professionals in the police, or in your case also in forensics. So actually, in some ways, it is a collaborative effort, and crime writers are all looking to get things write and also entertain.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, I know it's true south of the border as well, but in Scotland, our accessibility to Police Scotland and all the experts is second to none. I mean, it's fantastic. We've been invited. I was up at Gartcot, which is the big new centre with most fantastic forensic department. Well, it's just state-of-the-art Gartcot. And they invited a group of us up. Ian was there, Craig Robertson, Alex Gray. And we just got to sit with the head people and talk, because they are quite keen for you to get it right. Having said that, as Ian says, we're just representing a team. We couldn't possibly, you know, have 100 people in it, you know, which would be the sort of numbers that you're talking about. But we want to get the sense of it right. Certainly from my point of view with forensics, this particular book, the two main contributors in terms of expertise is James Reeves, Professor James Reeves at Aberdeen University, who's a forensic pathologist. He works with Anne Cleese as well. In fact, I think he is himself an Anne Cleese book in terms of, you know, her description of him. And also Cairngorm Mountain Rescue, because the book opens on the top of Cairngorm in a blizzard at Hogmanay. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? But, you know, Cairngorm Mountain Rescue has been absolutely to the fore with... And, oh, the stories were fantastic. And they take the expertise and, you know, fictionalise it within a story, but it makes it feel really authentic. And in James's case, of course, I didn't, you know, if it's minus 15 degrees, everything changes with respect to death. You know, so it's that sort of thing that when people read, they think, oh, you know, it feels real. And it's that marriage of, for me anyway, forensic fact and fiction is really important. And we're, you know, very grateful that we can access that expertise, and people are happy to help us.
Thanks to Lynn Anderson. Her books are available commercially in print, ebook, and as audio downloads.
And if you're listening to this live, or are very quick off the mark with the podcast, the Bloody Scotland Crime Writing Festival is on now, from the 8th to the 10th of September. For details and locations and tickets, head to www.bloodyscotland.com. And Lynn Anderson will be back talking Rona MacLeod and some of our other favourite books in a future edition of Read On.
Do you have a favourite author you'd like us to feature on the show? Or maybe you'd like us to focus on the hero of your favourite series? Why not drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, I'll be chatting to Ruta Sepetys on what winning this year's Silip Carnegie Medal means to her. But first... When it comes to the history of military intelligence, Ben McIntyre is the man. Over the past 25 years, he's published definitive accounts of counter-espionage during World War II, a biography of Kim Philby, a guide to Ian Fleming, and most recently, Rogue Heroes, the authorised wartime history of the SAS. With access to top secret files and the journalist's nose for a story, he has cast new light on the shadowy existence of the secret agent. Working behind enemy lines, those often flamboyant characters inhabit a world recognisable to fans of Ian Fleming and John le Carré alike. However, the stories recounted by Ben McIntyre actually happened, and the stakes really were life or death. Ben McIntyre, welcome to Read On Air.
So, what led you into the world of military intelligence?
Well, if I'm absolutely honest, I've always been fascinated by spying. And on leaving Cambridge, I was, in fact, briefly tapped up, as they say, to go and have a conversation with a man who gave me a false name in a location in London. Needless to say, they worked out pretty quickly that I was definitely not the stuff of spying, since I obviously couldn't keep a secret. I practically told everybody the moment I got out. But I've always thought that spying, both military and sort of civilian spying, if to put it that way, offers a backdrop that mostly novelists commandeer. It's the world of loyalty, love, betrayal, adventure, romance. Now that's normally the preserve of novelists. But if you can get access to sufficiently detailed material and proper documentary material, that's the stuff of spying. So it really addresses a world that in non-fiction is pretty unique, I think.
And how have you managed to gain access to that material? Presumably you've had to build quite a lot of trust within the corridors of secrecy.
Well, it's true. I mean, by now, I think I'm now on my sixth spy book, so I do know quite a lot of the people involved in all of that. But the truth is, I don't really get privileged access to documentary material. A lot of what I write about is in the National Archives. Starting under Blair, there was a real sea change in attitudes towards official secrecy in this country. The government decided progressively to start releasing MI5 files. Now, a crucial distinction, of course, is between MI5 and MI6. Both are military titles, Military Intelligence 5 and Military Intelligence 6. Of course, they've long ceased to be specifically military operations. But MI5 is the security service, which deals with threats to Britain's security. So they mostly work in Britain, although not exclusively. And then MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, is devoted to foreign intelligence. But again, not exclusively. They're also, you know, dealing with foreign sources in Britain. So there's a certain amount of overlap. MI6 will never release its files. They have a different philosophy, really, in approach. And it's completely understandable, really. They say, and I get this, that if they reveal the identity of agents, it becomes very, very difficult to recruit other agents. MI5 takes a very different view, which is that after 50 years, MI5 can begin, if it wishes to, there is a sort of grey area here, I use the term wishes to carefully, they can start releasing their files. And starting in 2002, that is exactly what they started doing. They started going back, particularly over the wartime files, and identifying specific cases that could, they believed, without threat to national security or embarrassing anyone's privacy, start to be released. And I was extraordinarily lucky. I mean, the first book that I wrote in this area was a book about a double agent called Eddie Chapman, who had been a sort of career criminal before the war, a tremendously engaging and extremely bad man, who found absolutely intriguing, but who ended up as an MI5 agent. He was in prison in Jersey at the time of the Nazi invasion of the Channel Islands and had volunteered his services to the Germans. He maintained as a way of escaping from prison, which I think was one of the reasons for doing it. He was also an amazing opportunist who couldn't resist that kind of offer. He was trained in a special spy school in France and then parachuted back into Britain on a kind of sabotage intelligence mission. This will give you an idea of what Chapman was like. The moment he landed, he immediately handed himself over to MI5 and offered to spy for them against the Germans. So he's an interesting case because, of course, he was picked up by MI5 because he was a threat to British security. And so, therefore, his files fall under that area. His files became accessible under the 50-year rule. And But interestingly, of course, Chapman was then redeployed back into occupied Europe. So in a way, he seems to be an MI6 agent, although he's being run by MI5. So that was an opportunity to write about foreign intelligence and this particular bizarre case with access to the full files. And the Zigzag files, he was codenamed Zigzag, which was a sort of internal MI5 joke because they were never quite sure whose side he was on. The joke going that, you know, a man who could zig could also zag, and therefore there was a possibility, that a strong possibility, that he might well have flipped back to the Germans. They were never absolutely sure whether to trust Eddie Chapman. And the Zigzag files were just the most incredible resource. I mean, they are, and I'm not exaggerating, they stand about 3 feet high. They contain letters, diaries, memos, photographs, poems written by Chapman in prison, all sorts of really detailed, that wonderful warp and weft that you can get from these files. Because, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about intelligence files is that they are honest in a way that most government files are not. Most official documentation is written by people who expect it to be read by the bosses. And so, therefore, it's almost always trying to frame a particular line. It's always either sort of doing in their rivals or making themselves feel good or look good to someone else. The intelligence files were never intended or expected to be read by anybody outside a very small circle of people. And so, therefore, they're absolutely honest about what's going on. And so when it goes wrong, as it frequently does in intelligence, instead of trying to cover it up or sort of blame someone else, they're completely open about the disasters. So you get this hilarious kind of marginalia in some of the files saying, you know, oh my God, we are completely up the creek with this one. And so I love that. I love the fact that you really felt you could get inside, to some extent, you could get inside the minds and the personalities, not just of the agents and the spies, but also of the case officers and the people running this bizarre organisation.
Well, there's certainly a collection of great eccentrics and mavericks and great, just great characters who one would be suspicious of if they turned up in a work of fiction. But actually, as you say, that their true characters come out of your books because of that honesty.
Well, I think it is partly the honesty. I think it's also that this world, this odd world of espionage, and I've never been quite sure whether it creates people who are slightly mad or whether it simply attracts people who are already slightly mad. And that goes for both the sort of the spies themselves and the people who are running them. It is a most eccentric and picaresque world. On the other hand, I mean, as Churchill himself observed, in order to want to be part of this strange process of spying on other people, you have to have a particular sort of character. Churchill called it a corkscrew mind. You don't think in straight lines. You think laterally often. You think in very imaginative ways. And that gives these people a real sort of patina to their lives that is quite different, I think, from really any other profession in the world. I mean, we have a funny attitude towards spying in Britain. We both don't trust it and find it slightly sinister, the idea of people keeping secrets. On the other hand, there is no country in the world more obsessed by its spies, starting with James Bond. Actually, not starting with James Bond, preceding James Bond by a considerable period. As a people, Britons are very good at spying. To coin a phrase, nobody does it better. And I think it is some element in the British character, this sort of theatricality, I don't think it's necessarily a love of mendacity exactly, but we love to make believe, we love to play, we love to play with the truth and to act things out. And I think it's no accident in a way that, you know, the greatest, really some of the greatest novelists of the 20th century were all spies. I mean, if you go back, Somerset Maugham, Ian Fleming, Graham Greene, John le Carré, Freddie Forsyth, they were all involved to some extent with the spy world, because spies are not so different from novelists in some ways. They make up a parallel world, a parallel fictional world, and the better they are at luring other people into it, the better they are at it.
And actually that came through very strongly in your follow-up to Agent Zigzag, Operation Mincemeat, about the ruse to wrongfoot the Germans as to where the Allies were going to invade in 1943. I believe there were three novelists working on the plot of Operation Mincemeat?
That's exactly right. I mean, Mincemeat was the most bizarre case, really. I mean, it was an attempt to fool the Germans into believing that the invasion from North Africa was going to start in Sicily. Not going to start in Sicily, but going to start in Greece and Sardinia. And to this end, they got hold of a dead body, which they had located in a coroner's in St. Pancras. They effectively stole it. And they invested this poor fellow, who was a sort of dead Welsh tramp, invested him with an entirely new personality. They turned him into someone else. They turned him into Major Martin of the Royal Marines, and they equipped him with a uniform and false papers and a briefcase chained to his hand. It sounds like it's a plot for a sort of mad Hollywood movie, which in fact it did subsequently become. And they released this body off the coast of Spain because they knew there was a particular spy operating on the coast of Spain who was tremendously efficient and obviously rather naive as well. And they believed if they could get these documents into his hands, it would pass all the way up the chain of command. And they were right. I mean, the bizarre thing is that having imagined this sort of parallel world, it began to take on reality. And the reason we know this, and the reason that the framers of this bizarre Operation Mincemeat, as they called it, again, a sort of in-joke, they just particularly thought it was rather macabre to have a dead body called Mincemeat. I mean, they were very odd, these people. As this thing, they could follow the lie going down the gullet, as it were, of German intelligence, because Bletchley Park was providing sort of real-time intelligence on what the Germans believed, and it became clear that this enormously elaborate set of lies was being swallowed, mincemeat, as they put it, was being swallowed whole. It rather panicked them, actually, because I think they hadn't realised it was going to work quite so well, and they began to wonder, crikey, I hope we've got this absolutely right, because if the Germans rumble us, they're going to realise it's the reverse of the truth, at which point they will realise the target is Sicily. So although, you know, it is a very amusing case in lots of ways, the stakes could not have been higher. I mean, 150,000 Allied troops were about to attack Sicily. If the Germans didn't believe this ruse, or worse, realised it was a ruse, Sicily was going to be heavily defended and there was going to be a bloodbath.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I first came across that story as The Man Who Never Was, I think an old black and white film that we probably watched on BBC Two when we were teenagers at home. Were you brought up with those sort of Second World War books and films?
Absolutely. I mean, I would spend, like many boys of my age, I would spend my Sunday afternoons watching Dambusters and, frankly, anything else with a wartime theme. So, no, I grew up on all that stuff. And The Man Who Never Was is actually a sort of cinematic classic in a way. It's based on the book written by one of the key architects of Operation Mincemeat, Ewan Montagu, who actually appears in the film as a sort of sceptical wing commander at the end, saying, "This will never work, you know, Bunty." So he sort of appears in his own film. I mean, I loved those films. I absolutely adored them. But the more I write about this area of history, the more I begin to realise that those black and white films, that sort of those rather propagandist films about how Britain won the war, are fundamentally very misleading. Because they're very black and white. War is not black and white. The more I write about this, the more I am convinced that yes, war is not a matter of black and white. War is painted in shades of grey. And it's about ordinary people having to make appalling decisions in circumstances not of their making. And to me, that's always been absolutely fascinating. And you find good people who find themselves having to do very bad things in war. And you find very bad people, like Eddie Chapman, who find themselves almost inadvertently on the right side of history. And I've always been fascinated by how people arrive at those sorts of decisions. What would you do? I mean, it seems to me that sort of history of the sort that I write, I hope at its best, asks the question, what would you do? How would you have responded in these circumstances? And one of the lovely things about going back to a story like The Man Who Never Was or Operation Mincemeat is being able to take the version that was told to us as children, that was told to us post-war, and really interrogate it, really take another look at it, and look at it through our sensibility, through what I would argue is a much more sophisticated sense of psychology and morality and ethics and opportunity, and be able to pose that question in a much less black and white way, really, to be able to say, actually, life is not like that. Life is a good deal more complicated and hairy.
And actually, you brought exactly that to the story of Kim Philby as well. Your book, A Spy Among Friends, The Great Betrayal, is far less hysterical than the sort of immediate post-defection books, and looks to explain why a man like Philby could betray his best friends and all his operatives.
I found the Philby story utterly fascinating. And again, I took it on with some trepidation, because this is a story that we all thought we knew, because it's absolutely sort of stitched into our cultural DNA, the defection of Kim Philby. But I think hysterical is a very good word to describe the way the defection and his career of espionage was portrayed immediately afterwards. It was simply, you know, he was a bad communist. You know, he was a liar, he was a cheat, he was a dissembler. He was, of course, all of those things. But he was a tremendously interesting man, and I think if we had met him, most of us would have found him utterly charming, completely plausible, terribly interesting, very concerned, highly intelligent. He's not a black-and-white figure, Philby, and having spent, gosh, nearly 3.5 years with Kim Philby, deeply digging as deeply as I could into him, I still found myself feeling intensely ambivalent about him. On the one hand, he was someone with steel in his heart, a sort of shard of ice. He was able to send people to their deaths without a single thought, plenty of thought, but absolutely no regret. I mean, and the death toll from Philby's betrayal numbers in the hundreds, if not the thousands. I mean, he betrayed entire operations in Albania, where not just the agents themselves were rounded up, but their families and friends, and all were executed. You know, I mean, the bloodshed was extraordinary. On the other hand, Philby was a most remarkable man. He was a brilliant intelligence officer. He really knew what he was doing, which is why, you know, he was so good at the job. And even at the end, I found myself, despite all the betrayal and so on, feeling that some part of me would still have enjoyed his company greatly.
The fanatical faith in communism came through, and I found myself thinking, had he had that fanatical faith in liberal democracy, then he would have been hailed as a great champion and maybe even been a great politician. But it was because it was something that made him into an enemy of the state that he had to be treated as such a pariah.
I think you put your finger on it. I mean, the truth is, I think had he not been a communist, had he been able to sort of, as it were, shed that early adherence, he would undoubtedly have been head of SIS. I think he would have ended up running MI6. He was destined for the top. He was a highly able, very subtle, supple man. His conversion to communism, again, was tended to be treated, it seemed to me, in the sort of post-defection world. I mean, when he went off to Russia in 1963 and never came back again. And that was treated as if, you know, this kind of die-hard, never-say-die communist had somehow sort of outwitted the Secret Service and run off. It wasn't quite like that. I mean, I think he was a pure-driven ideologue in the 1930s. There's no doubt that he and the rest of the Cambridge Five, Burgess, Maclean, and so on, they really did. They took the Kool-Aid. I mean, they absolutely believed wholeheartedly in this. Some stuck with it. Donald Maclean, I think, never wavered in his adherence. But Philby was different. I mean, he started out being motivated by pure ideology. I don't think that necessarily lasted through his lifetime, because we all change over time. I mean, there's a tendency, again, to see people as pure examples of political thought. Nobody's like that. Philby was also loved the adventure. He loved the romance. He was an intensely arrogant man, and he had that thing, which I think is a kind of British male, I hesitate to say this, a sort of male upper-class trait, which is that he liked to be a bit cleverer than the person standing next to him in the bus queue. He enjoyed that sensation of, in the book I describe it as the sort of ruthless exercise of private power. That's what he loved, and he got off on it. And after a while, that kind of infidelity becomes a drug. And Philby was, well, you can see it in his emotional life as well. I mean, he was an absolutely addicted philanderer and adulterer, much married, but absolutely never faithful. And that faithlessness itself, I think, became part of his character, part of his charm too, let's not deny it. But he wasn't, you know, to see him simply as an emblem of brutal communism is to reduce him.
Directing his own play, a sort of Prospero figure then, more than a ruthless communist in sort of reverse McCarthy.
I think that's exactly right. I think that is, yes, and that goes in a way for quite a lot of these characters. I mean, to go back to Eddie Chapman for a second, I mean, he too really considered himself to be the main actor in his own drama. He'd actually been a film extra early on in his life, and he lived the sort of life where he sort of imagined a film camera was running behind him the whole time. And so a certain sense of sort of self-inflating drama of being the star of your own show, albeit that nobody else knows that's what you're doing, absolutely animates many of these characters and runs through spying in general.
Thanks again to Ben McIntyre. Many of his books are available in a range of formats from the RNIB library, including Agent Zigzag, which is TB-15429, Operation Mincemeat, which is TB-17582, and A Foreign Field, which is TB-22009, which tells a previously forgotten story that happened during the First World War. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, and I'll be talking to the winner of this year's Philip Carnegie Medal after this.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
It may shock many people to know that in the UK, another 100 people start to lose their sight every day. Now, sight loss can happen to anyone at any time, and the RNIB is there to provide support when it does happen.
Frederick Forsyth on supporting Talking Books.
Talking Books is described as one of the RNIB's most important services. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, call 0845 345 0054 or visit www.rnib.org.uk.
The Philip Carnegie Medal is an annual award that recognises the best fiction for children and young adults. Now in its 80th year, it attracts entries from round the world. And this year, it was won by a Lithuanian-American author called Rūta Sepetys. Her novel, Salt to the Sea, retells the forgotten story of the worst maritime disaster in history. I spoke to her via Skype from her home in Nashville and began by asking her for her reaction to winning such an illustrious prize.
It's indescribable. It's a tremendous honor. And I joked with my family that I'm still waiting for the phone call that someone will tell me, oh, we're so sorry. There's been an error. But no, truly, it's incredible, especially for historical fiction. I'm so happy.
It's a wonderful achievement. It's a wonderful book. I know one of the things that you are given as well as the medal is a Braille copy of the book as well. Had you ever had a Braille copy of a book before?
No, I have never had a Braille edition of any of my books, and I'm so thrilled. It's going to sit on my bookshelf right behind my desk.
One of the lovely things about the Carnegie Medal is that the organisers have a long-standing agreement with the Royal National Institute for Blind People in the UK that provides accessible copies of all the shortlisted entries to RNIB members so that we can listen along or read in Braille along with the judges to judge who should be the winner. So presumably as an author, you're delighted to reach a wider audience.
I am, absolutely. And not because I wrote the books, but because of the history that my novels represent. Many of the people that I'm writing about believe that the world has forgotten them or that these pieces of history have slipped through the cracks. And so, yes, I'm anxious for the books and the associated history to reach as large an audience as possible.
You certainly give names and identities to the statistics. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about the real-life story behind Salt to the Sea?
Yes, definitely. Salt to the Sea is set in winter of 1945, and at this point, World War II was coming to an end, and Hitler knew that it did not look very positive for Germany. However, he forbid people to evacuate. He felt that if he allowed civilians to evacuate, it would affect morale. And so it became a very dire situation. And when evacuation orders were issued, for many, it was already too late. And millions of people pushed toward the port because that was the only place to escape. It was over water. And there was this massive refugee evacuation that some of my own family members were part of. And one of the ships commandeered for the evacuation was an old German cruise ship called the Wilhelm Gustloff. And the Gustloff held about 1,400 people, but when it sailed amidst a snowstorm on January 30th, 1945, it was carrying over 10,000 people. And it was torpedoed by a Soviet submarine, and it sank in less than 60 minutes, and over 9,000 people lost their lives, including over 5,000 children. And it's the single largest maritime disaster in history, but most people have never heard of it.
I certainly had never heard of it before reading your book, and I think one of the things that really came through about the book is just how varied the nationalities of the people involved in the disaster were, and that, well, no single group either has a monopoly on the tragedy or actually is totally blameless as far as the war going on around them is concerned. It's only the children who are the innocents, really.
That's exactly right. And I traveled to six different countries researching the book. And what made an impression on me is that human beings can experience the same event, but have a drastically different interpretation of it. And of course, based on their culture or the lens that they're looking through. And that's what inspired me to create these four different characters. And to your point, yes, there is much shared responsibility, and suffering truly emerged the victor of the war. And because my father was a child at this time, you know, that's always led me to wonder, what would it be like for the children, for these innocent victims of war and vengeful regimes who were then left with an inheritance and a responsibility for something that they had no role in causing? And that's what led me to focus on the story of the young people in Salt to the Sea.
And yet they also provide the hope.
They do. And that was another lesson that I learned from survivors and even family members of victims. They were sharing these lessons, such as that, you know, we don't choose our hardships, but we can choose how we face our hardships. And many of the people I spoke to, they wanted me to include elements of hope in the novel because they explained that it did exist. And for many people, that's what saved their lives.
It's an intensely moving book. And I know in the afterword you talk about having been fortunate enough to talk to survivors and read their accounts. Presumably an enormous amount of research went into this book. How do you know when to stop researching and start writing?
If I had it my way, I would never stop. I would never stop the research process. And even after the book is published, more information, keeps coming, which is so exciting. But for me, when I begin to hear similar stories over and over, or if I come upon information that I've already been over many times, then I know, okay, let's stop with the research. And I try to write and research at the same time, because I feel that if I can write as I am learning and researching the novel, perhaps the text will have an emotional immediacy, because certainly when I'm interviewing people and when I'm learning of their experience, it's very emotionally charged. And sometimes I fear that if I separate the research and the writing, that I'll lose a bit of that emotional pacing.
It's a great gift to enable your readers to empathize with people that they have never met. And, you know, in my case, actually, at one point, reduced me to tears because of the tragedy. I suppose knowing that you've done the research and felt those emotions yourself, that I suppose that's the way you managed to channel it into your writing.
Yes, I try. And also, this is an advantage that I'm afforded through fiction versus nonfiction. If I were to tell the story through nonfiction, perhaps I would follow the thread of one family, of one person. But with fiction, I can interview 100 people and weave pieces of different stories together into one character, with the goal being to create a character that you care about. And when I say care about, either meaning love or hate, because if you don't like a character, you will also follow them to the end to see what happens to them. But if I can create characters that feel human, you'll follow them for 300 pages, holding, you know, their hand and feeling their fear. And that's when a statistic becomes a human being, and when our heart opens and we feel this connection and we feel compelled to do something or to tell someone, or maybe we're emotionally moved. So with historical fiction, my creativity comes in the character development.
I love the anti-hero that you've created in Alfred. I think, you know, everybody knows an Alfred, and he is in exactly the right position in the book.
It's true. And for me, Alfred is also a study of visibility. What happens to a young boy who becomes a young man who's basically been rejected his entire life? He's been invisible, and suddenly he's given a uniform and he becomes very visible, if only in his own mind. And to create the character of Alfred, I studied Adolf Hitler as a teen. As a teenager, Hitler composed these letters to a girl named Stephanie, and they were so inflated, almost, it could be argued, delusional, but he never mailed these letters. But we saw a glimpse of Hitler and as a young boy and how he thought and felt about himself and his future. And so that was one of my techniques for creating Alfred.
Fascinating. Yes, well, one wonders what he might have become. And also, you have a blind character in the book as well. Where did the inspiration for Ingrid come from?
When I was interviewing refugees, they were explaining the dire situation at the train stations, that there were so many people looking to board these trains that people were being left behind. And a woman told me that she remembered being on a train and pushed toward the window, seeing a young blind woman all alone on the platform, calling out, and she was all alone. And that absolutely moved me. And I thought so much. And of course, I was asking so many questions of the woman. I said, well, what did you know? And did someone get off the train? And did someone help her? And I said, I don't know. Mm. So I just felt so compelled, to include that in the novel.
And of course, the blind and the otherwise disabled were viewed as garbage for disinfection by Hitler and the Nazis.
Yes, and I include that in the novel, that Alfred is referring to, that there are termed garbage children, life unworthy of life. And that's something that when I do school visits, young readers, that's probably the first thing that they call out. And one of the many reasons that I'm so honored to write for young readers, they have such a sense of justice, and they're truly moved to make a difference, and they have so much energy. And that has been something that young readers have repeatedly referenced in the book.
You write about some pretty hard-hitting facts of war, and I know in your other two novels about totalitarianism and also about brothels. Do you think there is a line beyond which one shouldn't stray in young adult fiction, or do you think children should be exposed to all the horrors of the adult world?
I don't think there is a line that should be drawn. What I do as a writer, I challenge myself to describe things in a way that if these things are within the reader's consciousness at the age when they read the book, that they will absorb what's going on. But perhaps if not, that they won't. And so I challenge myself that way, and certainly try not to be gratuitous, but also I respect the fact that, parents, I admire parents who are involved with what their children are reading, and if they don't feel it's appropriate, I completely respect that. But my experience has been that young readers have a very profound sense of emotional truth. They feel things very deeply. And so books that we read at 12, 13, 14, they have the ability to make an impression on us, a lasting impression. I think everyone listening can remember a book that they read when they were young. Those books stay with us. And so if I can share information about these underrepresented parts of history and put them into the caring and gentle hands of young readers, that would make me so happy. But yes, I do try to challenge myself to do it in a careful and responsible way.
And I certainly think you succeed. I think also, there are warnings from history that need to be heeded in an age where refugees are fleeing across the Mediterranean. It's quite pertinent to remember that 80 years ago, refugees were fleeing across Europe. You mention Ukraine a few times in the book, and obviously Ukraine, again, is subject to invasion by Russia. Was that in your mind when you were writing the book?
Well, it's always been in my mind because I'm the daughter of a refugee, and 77 years ago, that refugee child was my father. So, my father fled from Lithuania when the Soviets occupied and wasn't able to return to Lithuania for 50 years. So, yes, it's always on my mind, as is the plight of the children. Like I said, these innocent victims. So, yes, Ukraine is always on my mind and in my heart.
And again, from the afterword, you say that this is really the research of the book was really a global collaborative effort, that it is through researching historical documents, talking to people and reading accounts from the past, that actually you create a global community of readers who might not make the same mistakes again. You clearly feel that very strongly.
I do. And I know that for many, writing is a solitary endeavor, and researching is as well. But for me, it's a bit of a team sport. I had a tremendous research partner, Klaus Petersen in Denmark, who helped me quite a bit. And several of the divers, the deep sea divers that had explored the sunken Guslof, they helped enormously. I am not a diver myself, and could now it's also illegal to explore the sunken ship. But there were two Polish divers that had explored the ship quite early on. They're elderly men now. And they spent several days with me, not only explaining about the tragedy and what they experienced under, you know, in the Baltic Sea, but together we also walked the path of the refugees. And granted, I was walking in spring, and it was a difficult walk, and I couldn't fathom what it would be like to walk in the dead of winter. And I would never have had access to that kind of experience without these people. And they played such a large role. And even there's an author, a writer, Catherine Prince. She's a writer and journalist, and she had written a nonfiction book on the Guslof called Death in the Baltic. And she so generously shared her research with me and some of her contacts. And so I'm so grateful. I think it really brought an extra dimension to the novel.
Well, it is a fantastic achievement, an amazingly moving read. Thank you so much for sharing some insights into Salt to the Sea, and many, many congratulations again.
Thank you so, so much. I truly appreciate it. An author has nothing without readers.
Salt to the Sea is currently available as a commercial audiobook and also in print and ebook. Thanks to a long-standing agreement between the RNIB and the organisers of the Sylip Carnegie Medal, Braille, giant print and a synthetic voice version of all the books on this year's shortlist are available from the RNIB library, including Salt to the Sea, are available free to RNIB members. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. So that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Ben, Lynn and Ruta. And to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and author interviews. Simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.